Well, thanks for walking all the way through here. It's a long green carpet. my talk today will be, I'll be focused on sharing some research data about a trigger project that we have in South Florida, where we are evaluating the impacts of some bioenergy crops on soil and water resources. I also want to acknowledge my co-authors, Shaolin Su, with a master's degree student, and Drs. João Vendramini, Lynn Sonnenberger, and George O'Connor. As many of you probably know, phosphorus accumulation in agricultural soils is, and subsequent transport to surface water is a major concern in the U.S. and other developed countries. Unfortunately, some of the alternatives or strategies to mitigate phosphorus-impacted soils, they either reduce the payload, such as, let's say, BMP, where you manage manure and fertilizer and animal diet, so you reduce the payloads that are entering the soil, or you reduce the pre-transport potential, such as you adapt the filters, strips, cover crops, or you can use chemical amendments. Chemical amendments is being proved. There's extensive research showing that chemical amendments can be effective, but there are also some disadvantages. For instance, high cost if you're talking about pure chemicals like alum, or even transportation costs if you're talking about water treatment residuals. And also there's insufficient supply. And furthermore, the phosphorus that is mobilized by these chemical amendments can be further, can become available, such as if the phosphorus lost via runoff, phosphorus can again become available. So our objective in this project was to explore some plant-based strategies to phytoremediate phosphorus from these manure-impacted soils. One of the advantages is you remove phosphorus from the soil, and another advantage if we can use some of these highly productive energy crops, the harvest biomass can also be used for bioenergy production. So some of the desirable characteristics for this species, of course, they should have high biomass potential, high pea uptake potential, and also they should be adapted to our soil and environmental conditions. And in Florida, we have pretty different environmental soil conditions as you go from the north to the south part of the state. I'm going to talk about this a little bit further. But what are the major limitations associated with plant-based strategies to remediate soil P? One of them, if you looked over the literature, most of the crops that we normally use, the tissue P concentration is fairly low. It varies anything from 0.1 to 0.9%. They also have relatively low phosphorus removal rates. We also don't have any or very few research about the long-term effectiveness. So once you establish these crops in phosphorus-impacted soils, how long do you continue be efficient as far as removing phosphorus? Again, my talk is focused on phosphorus, but in order to remove phosphorus, probably we have to apply nitrogen. So what are the fertilizer requirements, and more importantly, what will be the potential of this heavy fertilizer application on soil and water resources? So if we're solving the phosphorus issue, are we creating a nitrogen issue? And again, what are the environmental trade-offs, not only in terms of water quality, but also greenhouse gas emissions? If I want to produce high yields and I'm applying heavy nitrogen fertilizer rates, am I creating a condition where nitrous oxide can become a problem? So our field study, we divided into two objectives. The first one was just to test a number of entries and see whether or not they were adapted to South Florida conditions. And one of the major conditions that we have, that most of the bioenergy crops that we have in other parts of the countries, is that we have poorly drained soils. So some of the species that perform well in other parts of the country, even in North Florida, they don't do very well in South Florida because of the poorly drained soils. We also, under the specific aim too, we also want to see select out of those 15 entries, we want to select the ones that were most promising and see in a larger scale what would be the potential on groundwater, surface groundwater peak concentration, as well as soil test peak concentrations. Here are the 15 entries that we used in a small scale, small plots. Most of them are warm season grasses. We also tested elephant grass, which we've been doing a lot of research in South Florida with elephant grass. It seems to be one of the most promising bioenergy crop. We tested sugarcane, stargrass, in the system where we were working with, which was dairy farms, stargrass is the most predominant forage. Of course, Bahia grass is the most planted species, and we also test some Bermuda grass, switchgrass. In the large scale study where we are also evaluating the water quality, we selected these first four species, elephant grass, sugarcane, stargrass as our control. So what would happen if we didn't change the species the producer currently had, what would happen? And also switchgrass because of the interest in bioenergy. And there's not a lot of research with switchgrass in South Florida. We were not sure whether or not switchgrass would tolerate the poorly drained soil conditions. Our study site was a private dairy farm. Livestock production systems in Florida are quite different from other places in the country because we don't have confined animal operations. But we have situations like this where dairy farmers, they keep their animals pretty much in the pasture all the time. They are not in a confined situation, but of course the manure and the phosphorus that it's being added through the animal feed goes back directly to the soil. So in this case, this particular site was grazed for over 50 years. The initial soil test, which is our medic one, was 700 milligrams per kilogram. Just to give an idea, anything above 50 is considered non-responsive in terms of P application. Anything when the soil test P is above 50, plants will likely not, I'm sorry, 16. When it's above 16, plants will likely not respond. And the soils were sandy, poorly drained. I'm going to show you another picture where I'm going to talk about a little bit more about the soil because the soil has some important characteristics as well. Here's the site. If you probably, most of you probably are not aware of where Ona is. Here's Genzu, this green dot. We are located in this region here. One of the important environmental concerns, if you see in this picture, here's the Lake Okeechobee, which is an important water body in Florida. And all this basin drains to the Lake Okeechobee. So it's one of the most heavily regulated areas in the country as far as water quality regulations. And this basin is primarily dominated by beef cattle producers. So we picked one place where this kind of study would be relevant. Just to give an idea of the site, we disked the existing vegetation, fenced, just to give an idea what the existing vegetation looked like. And of course, we prohibited the animals to have access to this site. Fertilization and harvest regimes are important because, again, we were concerned about the nitrogen. Even though the phosphorus was our major concern, we were also concerned about the potential impact of heavy nitrogen fertilization. Sugarcane was only harvested once a year, and we applied 200 kilos of nitrogen per hectare. Elephant grass was harvested at 12 weeks interval and received 160 kilos of nitrogen per hectare. And the small grass, what we are calling small grass, which is pretty much everything else, was harvested at 6 weeks and received 80 kilos of nitrogen per hectare. So basically, the elephant grass and small grasses, they received the same nitrogen fertilizer load. Even though they were harvested at different intervals, the total annual nitrogen application was the same. Like I said, this is a three-year study. In 2007 was the year that we established, so we only had three harvests, 2008, seven harvests, and 2009, six harvests. Samples were analyzed for tissue peat, nitrogen, soil samples were taken from three different depths, and we also installed lysimeters above and below what we call the spodic horizon. Here's an important characteristic of our soils. This is the predominant soil type in my region. It's called spodosol. The surface AP horizon has very low, very limited phosphorus retention capacity. But the spotic horizon, which typically occurs at 20, 22 inches deep, has a pretty significant amount of iron and aluminum, and it can retain P. So we install our lysimeters above and below that spodic horizon because we know there's some differences in terms of phosphorus dynamics in the soil profile. Dry matter yields in megagrams per hectare per year. In the small scale plots, elephant grass and sugarcane produced had the highest yield. Elephant grass produced roughly 45 tons of dry matter per year, and sugarcane was about the same, 42. Switchgrass didn't do very well. Actually, the second year of experiment, we lost our switchgrass. We tried to reestablish, but some of these grasses, it just didn't survive the poorly drained conditions, including switchgrass. In terms of phosphorus uptake potential, again, elephant grass showed the highest potential, 126 kilos of phosphorus per hectare per year. And even though sugarcane here produced as much as, almost the same as the elephant grass, the P uptake was considerably less because the tissue P concentration, in sugarcane is much smaller than any other entry we had in this study. And again, in the large scale plots where we select for various reasons, we select these four species, again, we saw similar results. Elephant grass had the highest yield, followed by sugarcane. Star grass, which would be considered our control, what the producer would normally have, had a lower yield compared to elephant grass and sugarcane. Again, phosphorus uptake followed the same pattern. 139 kilos of phosphorus per hectare per year. So it's a considerable amount of phosphorus that can be removed as long as you are not recycling that biomass back into the system. So our idea was not to feed the animals back, not use that biomass to feed the animals, because otherwise we would be just moving phosphorus around the same property. Again, just to give an idea why tissue P concentration of sugarcane was 1.8 versus something like 4. 0.4% for the other grasses. That's why P uptake was smaller for elephant grass. I'm sorry, sugarcane. In terms of soil P concentrations, this is the average across all treatments, all four species. From the gray solid bar is the surface horizon, the AP horizon. There was a clear reduction in soil P concentrations in the AP horizon. But if you looked at the day horizon, which is the second bar here, there's not much difference. But if you look at the pH horizon, the spodic horizon, it looks like there's a trend, an increasing in soil P concentration. Let me move to another slide and we can talk about that. Same thing with the water extractable P. Sometimes soil test P are not a good indicator of environmental potential for phosphorus to be transported from the soil. So we use also water extractable P as another indicator. Same trend, decreasing soil water extractable P concentration in the surface horizon, and as a function of the phosphorus that was removed with the crop harvest. But we also notice an increase in the BH horizon. So one of the hypotheses we are testing is when we established these crops, we disturbed the soil. And the soil was heavily impacted. It had 700 milligrams of phosphorus per kilogram. So we think that part of the phosphorus was probably leached down in the profile. Actually, if we do a quick mass balance, see how much the crop P removal uptake explains that difference, we're going to see that there's a large amount of phosphorus that was removed that is not explained by the crop removal. So there's something else going on in the sites besides the crop removal. And we think it was a disturbance we caused when we established the plots. In terms of water quality, ortho P concentration in the leachates, again, the lowest P concentration, the solid bars are the shallow lysimeter, the 60-centimeter lysimeter. And the second bar is the lysimeter that was installed below the BH horizon. As we expected, the lysimeter that was at the BH horizon had lower P concentration because, like I told you, the spodic horizon has a pretty strong affinity to retain P versus the A horizon, which doesn't have much minerals to retain P. This trend was almost the opposite. If you look at the, if you remember the graph that I showed you, the P uptake, this is almost the opposite. So the lowest, the smallest peak concentrations were observed in the plots where we were growing elephant grass. Again, I think this is kind of misleading because the switchgrass, it died after the second year. So it was, this should be switchgrass slash weeds. And even though nitrate was not our major concern, but we also want to see what we were causing in terms of nitrate leaching. And we were pretty surprised to see how much nitrate, the nitrate concentrations, again, those are not loads, those are concentrations, but how much nitrogen, nitrate leaching we were causing. And there's not a directly related relationship with the nitrogen fertilization, so we think that this issue deserves some further investigation. Some of the conclusions. Elephant grass can be a feasible alternative for both remediation and bioenergy production in our region, in South Florida. But if we do a quick calculation here, how much time would be required to reduce excess P? It's very, very simple calculation. Let's say the initial concentration is 700 milligrams per kilogram, which would be equivalent to 1,400 kilos of P per hectare. If the goal is to reduce to what we call acceptable P concentration in terms of agronomic and environmental impacts, let's use 50 as a goal. That means 100, which will be equivalent to 100 kilos of P per hectare. And considering the P uptake will be constant, which we don't think that's true, but assuming that the P uptake phosphorus removal potential will be constant over time, it will be 130 kilograms per hectare per year, we will need at least 10 years to remove sufficient phosphorus from the soil. So it's, we think that phytoremediation alone is not going to be the answer. Probably if we use the plant-based strategies combined with some other techniques like the chemical amendments might be a better approach. And the other concern is relative to nitrogen application in terms of water quality and greenhouse gas emissions. So there's definitely a need for further studies to evaluate the impact of nitrogen application. With that, this is a picture of the elephant grass after, I think it was 6 weeks after we harvest, so it's amazing how fast those plants can grow. Thank you so much.
We have time for one question. For Maria.
Yes, sir.
I'm just curious, it's not too surprising, I guess, in those low drainage conditions that the switchgrass would die out, but especially with that kind of fairly rigorous harvest intensity to go every 6 weeks on switchgrass and on some of the other grasses. I'm curious on that one and some of the other ones that didn't perform so well. Would there be another harvest strategy that you might recommend that might aid them in their survival? And they may not even be useful anyway, but I was just curious.
It could be, but because the soil fertility conditions were pretty good when we started with, and because we were applying pretty heavy nitrogen fertilization rates, we thought that even though the harvest schedule was pretty intensive, that would overcome, our fertilization regime would overcome the potential negative effect of the harvest regime. But I think the major issue was the water staining, especially in the summer. That's when most of the plots died. It was in the summer.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you.